The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Jim Canales, president of the Barr Foundation, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
No matter what the field of endeavor, we all enjoy watching organizations take shape, emerge and grow, and evolve into something that increases their effectiveness and impact. There's a foundation based in Boston that fits that description to a T. It's the Barr Foundation, and it is fortunate to be led by one of the most capable individuals in the field of philanthropy, and he just happens to be with us now. He is Jim Canales, the president and CEO of the Barr Foundation. Good evening, Jim, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver, and thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about the Barr Foundation and of your mission and goals.
So the Barr Foundation has been around for about 20 years. We have assets of $1.7 billion, and we grant approximately $80 million a year in the areas of arts and creativity and climate and education.
You know, the evolution of the Barr Foundation, at least for me, has been a fascinating thing to watch. You know, it started out as sort of an anonymous giving entity, and it evolved into a family foundation, and now it has become a professional operation and a major legacy foundation. Tell us about that journey, Jim, and some of the challenges along the way.
So the foundation was created by two individuals who are enormously generous and strategic about the kind of impact they want to have. Amos and Barbara Hostetter created the foundation 20 years ago. Amos was one of the co-founders of Continental Cablevision, and that's what led to the opportunity to create the foundation. The foundation has grown over time from that initial gift to, as I said earlier, $1.7 billion in assets. And the foundation did start anonymously, and it began anonymously because Barbara and Amos felt very strongly that it was important to focus on the work and not to focus on the foundation itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's evolved over time. And interestingly enough, part of the reason that it has evolved has been feedback from the grantees of the foundation, many of whom said to the Barr Foundation almost a decade ago that it was actually better for them to be able to be public about where the funds were coming from, that the foundation had achieved a certain kind of reputation in the community as a thoughtful grant maker, and that being anonymous was not necessarily serving them well. And that, I think, was a pivot for the foundation. Now, I arrived in 2014, so right. I've only been there for about 3.5 years. And in that time, there's a lot that we have done, and there's a lot more that we have to do.
Oh, I bet. But that's good to have co-founders who listen, and they listened, and they acted on that listening. You know, you mentioned a moment ago you have three major program areas. I'm going to ask you to say a word or two about each one. The first is arts and creativity, and lots of things going on here, like Boston Creates. What's your overarching goal of your arts and creativity program?
So arts and creativity is focused on the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So originally, the arts program had a focus on Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of a strategic planning effort that we went through a couple of years ago, we made the decision that Barr was going to take a more regional approach to its grant making. And within that, we decided that arts and creativity would become a statewide program. And our focus is, how do we create and foster a creative, vibrant, cultural, and artistic community for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? And we focus in three principal areas. One is, how do we invest in arts organizations so that they can become adaptive and relevant given so many changes that are going on around them, which I'm happy to get into. We also focus on ways that the arts can connect with other sectors in ways that ultimately contribute to that vibrancy that I described a moment ago. And then we also focus on ways to build advocacy on behalf of the arts.
Yeah. Arts have really become a key driver in urban renewal, haven't they?
They have. And in fact, we've seen a lot of that in the Commonwealth. One of our partnerships is with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and we focus on ways that we might revitalize certain cities that have suffered significant changes because of changes in industry, and ways that certain spaces that have lied, that have been fallow, basically, could be revitalized and used for creative purposes. And so this is one of the partnerships that we've been engaged in the last number of years, and we see it as a hopeful sign to think about ways that you can repurpose these old mills, these old buildings, these old factories to foster the kind of creativity and the kind of entrepreneurship that I think will help these cities to turn things around.
Great stuff. Second program is around climate. Now, we sometimes don't think of a locally focused organization doing something on climate, but that would not be the case. And part of your focus there is around an initiative called Smarter Travel, Smarter Places. What's the strategy here?
So the strategy for that evolved from a decision that was made about 7 years ago. The foundation had a broad-based environment program up until that time. And in 2010, the foundation trustees made the decision that it was evident that climate change was one of the most urgent and pressing issues of our time. And as a result, that the environment program should shift into a climate program. And in deciding how to focus the climate program, they looked at what were the greatest sources of greenhouse gas emissions in the region. And they were buildings and transportation. And so that's what led to a focus on energy and on transportation as two core areas of focus. We did that work for about 5 years. And as part of a planning effort that we undertook a couple of years ago, we shifted to a focus on clean energy and renewables, and then a focus on mobility. So what we think about with our mobility focus is how we can achieve two things: how we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and at the same time, focus on how we help people to get where they need to get in a more efficient and effective way.
Mm-hmm. Human-centered design to a certain degree. It's around people.
It's very true.
Mm-hmm. And finally, there is education, and your concentration here is around secondary schools and your desire to see that all students succeed. What is working there, and what are you especially excited about these days?
So I think your emphasis on all students is absolutely right. And many people across the country look at the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and say, wow, Massachusetts is a real success story. Across many indices, Massachusetts is often at the top in terms of student achievement and in terms of other measures that we use to assess academic achievement. But underneath that data, you come to realize that it may not be that excellent for all students. Mm-hmm. And that's what led us to focus on ways that we can think about re-envisioning secondary education in ways that create more relevant experiences for students when they're in high school, in ways that help them to connect to both post-secondary and career opportunities, and also in ways that perhaps personalize the experience and that realize that every student comes at this from a different perspective and with a different set of competencies. And if we can reimagine the way we deliver secondary education in a way that acknowledges the need for that kind of personalization, we can really make a significant difference for those students, particularly those who are at greatest risk of dropping out.
Can you give us an example of one of the things that you're supporting?
Sure. So one of the things that we're most excited about that we launched last year is a $30 million initiative over the next 5 years that is particularly focused on helping those students who are off track. And off track students are those who are at greatest risk of being disconnected from either their academic tracks or even disconnected from work to the extent they're not in school. And so our effort is, how can we create models that are effective at engaging students who are off track, that help them to be successful in those academic environments, and to create pathways for them to connect to post-secondary education or to career opportunities if that's what's relevant for them.
Mm-hmm. And one last and maybe relatively new program area, if you will, is this cross program initiative. How does that work, and what has the yield been from it so far?
So it's early going for us in mm-hmm. terms of cross-program initiatives, and let me say a little bit about its genesis. We have these three program areas. We're structured as many foundations are with these subject matter areas and fields that we focus on of arts and creativity and climate and education. But we also thought long and hard in our strategic planning effort about ways that we could engage in activities that might, in essence, undergird all of that. So one of the areas of focusing cross-program initiatives is around leadership. Hmm. And so we think not only about strategies that we can employ within our programs that advance the leadership capacity of organizations that we are supporting, but we also think about other initiatives that we might undertake. So for example, we have had since 2005 a program called the Bar Fellows Program. And the Bar Fellowship provides a great opportunity for about a dozen effective leaders in the Boston area. We award these fellowships every 2 years, and we provide these dozen leaders with an opportunity to engage with one another, engage with a peer cohort, for an opportunity to disengage from their day-to-day work by providing them with a sabbatical experience, an opportunity to do a global trip together so that they can understand how some of the issues that they work on in the region actually play out in other settings. And it's a 2-year opportunity that really does create a sense of fellowship for these leaders. And we often find that for leaders who are really committed, really passionate, and really dedicated, they often don't take the time to take care of themselves and to think about their own ongoing growth and development. And that's the purpose of the program.
That's so needed and it is so important. You know, you mentioned a moment ago the Barr Foundation is de deeply committed to the greater Boston area and now the whole New England region, and I don't think anywhere is that more evident than your engagement around one of the region's treasures, and that's the Boston waterfront. Share with our listeners what is happening with it and the role the Barr Foundation is playing in connection with this civic enterprise.
So I suspect that many of your listeners will recall the infamous project from several decades ago known as the Big Dig, because it received a lot of national attention because it was a significant infrastructure project that, as you know—
That lasted several decades.
That lasted several decades, and that, as you know, depressed the central artery to create an opportunity for better mobility, of course, but perhaps most importantly, to also think about ways to connect the city to the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
One of the abiding concerns that we have about the waterfront and the reason that we're engaged in it is that we think of Barr's role as adopting a long-term perspective and thinking about how decisions that we make today are going to have an impact for future generations. And in Boston, there has been significant development that has taken place in an area that was known as the Innovation District, variably South Boston. It has multiple names that are often attached to it, the Seaport. But this is an area that has undergone significant growth over the last number of years. And lots of buildings have popped up, and many people will say that it's a neighborhood that now looks very different than it did a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
Our concern has been, what are we doing to ensure that the waterfront remains a treasure that we are stewarding and remains a treasure that is attentive to issues of open space, that is attentive to issues of access for all residents and visitors to Boston, and also attentive to issues of resiliency? And I'll come back to that point in a moment because it's a real issue for us in Boston given our location. So the Waterfront Initiative is our effort to ensure that we're helping the city and the broader region think about how we ensure that this treasure is something that we steward in the right ways and that we're not making decisions today that are going to have a bad impact for future generations.
Mm-hmm. You know, so many people today believe that the future is being created in cities and not so much anymore at the state or the national level. And foundations like yours are playing a more active and energetic role across the country. I think two great examples would be Heinz Endowments in Pittsburgh and Kresge in Detroit. How do you see the role of philanthropy and foundations changing in this regard? And what, in addition to the resources you can bring, are you bringing to the table?
So I think cities, many people have written that cities are a really fundamental agent of change in this era. And in fact, given our focus on climate, many people will look at the work that we do and say, well, you're addressing such a large issue and it's a global issue and there's probably not a lot that you can do in a regional way. But the reality is many people say that on the climate question, that a lot of the action is happening at the local level, cities and states. And that's why we engage in that way. I think for us in Boston, we have a great opportunity as a foundation to be a constructive partner to the city of Boston on a number of initiatives where we have shared goals and we are aligned with regard to our priorities. Boston has had a new mayor for the last 3.5 years,
right.
Mayor Walsh, who inherited a legacy of Mayor Menino, who had been there for 2 decades in that role. And with Mayor Walsh's arrival, it has offered an opportunity for Boston to think in new and fresh and different ways. And he kicked off for the first time in 50 years a major citywide planning effort to think about what do we want Boston to look like in 2030,
mm-hmm.
an effort entitled Imagine Boston 2030. There are a number of components of that project that we were involved in directly because we felt that philanthropy could play a unique role to ensure that this kind of planning was done with the kind of thoroughness and with the level of community engagement that the mayor was deeply committed to and that we knew was going to produce a better outcome than simply having this be a top-down plan that had been developed. So for us, the ability to work in partnership with the city, to think about ways that we can be constructive partners together, to acknowledge that no single sector is going to have a monopoly on all of the solutions. These are tough issues, and they're going to require multiple sectors coming together to address them, and that's the role that we want to play.
Well, you know, your involvement with City Hall, I think it's probably welcomed by most people, but like all things, not by all. I mean, has there been any pushback for the level of influence that you have at City Hall and how to react to that pushback?
Well, there has been. There have been stories that have talked about the Barr Foundation being a source of unelected power in Boston. And my response to that is that I think we view our role not as trying to drive any particular kind of outcome, but rather as ensuring that we're informing the work that is taking place at the city in a way that, again, is broad-based, in a way that brings many voices to the table, in a way that ensures that good data and research is informing decisions that might be made, and in a way that is consistent with our values and the kinds of goals that we have for the foundation.
Mm-hmm. I had Derek Rapp, the CEO of the JDRF Foundation, on the show the other day. I never really fully appreciated how difficult it was for somebody with type 1 diabetes to keep things in balance. You got to keep the sugar not too high, not too low, and the environment around you is always in a state of flux, whether it's your hormones or stress or the amount of exercise. Now, I'm not comparing what you do to that, but balance in your work is critical, and it can be really difficult to achieve. What are some of the tensions that you experience in doing that, and what do you do to maintain a healthy balance?
I love the analogy about balance. It's such a good one, and I think then the way you frame it around tensions is so appropriate to the work that we do in foundations. I think in philanthropy, we are often balancing many kinds of tensions. One example is we often think about the focus on outcomes. Mm-hmm. And as you know, there's been such an emphasis over the last decade plus on foundations needing to be more focused on outcomes, on the need for logic models and theories of change. And that's a lot of jargon that essentially speaks to the importance of being clear about what we're trying to do with our resources. And at the same time, we also think about philanthropy as being the risk capital for the social sector and the opportunity to invest in ideas that are innovative, that are perhaps going to fail. And sometimes those come into tension with one another, because if you're solely focused on a particular kind of outcome, and in fact, if you're solely focused on being able to measure the work that you're doing as a foundation, you might miss those opportunities to invest that kind of risk capital in a sector that desperately needs that kind of investment and looks to private philanthropy in particular to be that sort of investor.
Now, that's a great point. You know, another one of those tensions is between adopting a long-term perspective, something which foundations can uniquely do, and addressing those urgent needs that are lining up outside your front door. Give us an example where you've encountered that kind of attention and how you sought to maintain a balance while addressing it.
I described earlier how we had gone through a strategic planning process a few years ago, and we completed that process at the end of 2015 and announced a whole new set of priorities and directions for our grant making in early 2016, and had been doing that work for that year. And then we had the presidential election in November of 2016. And this is less a political statement, but more about some of the after effects that we were seeing as we turned into this past year. One of the things that we were seeing is we were concerned about the particular vulnerabilities for immigrant and refugee populations, given some of the policies that were being advanced by the new administration. We were also concerned about, and interesting to say this as we sit in a radio studio, we were concerned about attacks on the media, mm-hmm. And the idea that the media were the enemy of the American people, which I believe was a quote. And both of those realizations led us in the early part of this year to announce a special initiative, a $3.5 million commitment by our foundation to two strands of work, one around supporting frontline organizations in Massachusetts that were dealing with an influx of need from immigrant and refugee populations, and second, investing in investigative journalism, which is, as many people in media would tell you, is expensive, is hard to do, takes time, takes resources, and we wanted to be sure that entities that were doing that kind of work had the resources at their disposal to do their best work. So that was an example where a year out of a strategic planning effort, we had to do some recalibration and think about some reallocation of resources because the environment around us had shifted. And I think for all foundations, we are constantly thinking about this balance of how do you stay focused and be clear and have impact over a certain period of time, but at the same time, not do it in a way where your head's in the sand and you're not acknowledging that things are changing around us and we need to be attentive to that change.
A very balanced answer and well stated, I might add. Let me ask you something about the sector at large, and this has to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there certainly have been some thoughtful and well-intentioned efforts around this, but they haven't been all that effective. And that was really brought home to me the other day when I looked at this Board Source report that just came out. And it indicated that 90% of all nonprofit CEOs are white and 84% of board members are white. And the thing that I was really struck by is that those numbers have actually gone up since 2015. As a matter of fact, when it came to all white boards, that went from 25% to 27%. And this is really just one indicator of diversity. So why do you think these these initiatives are not working as well as they should, and what do you think needs to be done to make this effort more effective?
Well, this is a big issue. When you look at the demographic changes that are taking place across our country, those numbers that you're reading are not reflective of not only our current demography, but also not reflective of the kind of demographic shifts that we are going to be seeing in the future. I think with regard to the nonprofit sector, and I think a lot about philanthropy, where this is an issue that often comes up in terms of the lack of people of color in leadership roles, it is interesting that of the 25 largest foundations by asset size, six of those are led by people of color. Probably not the most impressive statistic to say that roughly a quarter are led by people of color, but I dare say that if you looked at that data maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it would probably look different, and I think that the trend line has gone up, and that's a good development.
Sure is.
At the heart of this, though, I think is the question of governance and the role of the boards and how the boards are constituted and how boards make decisions when there is leadership change and the emphasis or not that they place on diversity in thinking about leadership roles, and not just the executive leadership roles, but even investment in ensuring that you're developing a pipeline and whether that pipeline will lead to your organization or will lead to other organizations. That's an institutional investment that you're making and a statement that you're making about the importance of diversity in your institution.
You know, you are a California boy, Jim, through and through. And when you accepted this job at Barr Foundation, you moved from one of America's great cities, San Francisco, to another one of America's favorite cities, that being Boston. What has that adjustment been like for you? And what are some of the differences that you've observed in how each city goes about its business and gets things done?
Well, other than the fact that I had to very quickly trade my San Francisco Giants hat for a Red Sox cap, that was certainly an adjustment for me. As you note, I'm not only a native Californian, but a native San Franciscan. So
right.
I'd spent most of my life in that very city. And I feel incredibly fortunate to have made a move from one world-class city to another world-class city. Cities are very similar in some respects. They're similar in population size, they're similar in scale, even similar in terms of having vibrant waterfronts. And so in that sense, it's been a good change. Winter has been something to adjust to, of course.
You never adjust.
You never adjust. And of course, my first winter was that horrific winter of 2014-2015 when we had record snow in Boston. So the cities are in some ways very different. And in other ways, they're also very similar, but in other ways, they're also quite different. And one of the ways that they're different is that philanthropy is very different in Boston. There is a culture that is more anonymous in its style. There is a culture that it often aims to do that kind of work quietly. And that's not to imply that in California, people were trumpeting what they were doing. But of course, California is the home of venture philanthropy. It's the home of Silicon Valley. There's a very different kind of approach and style, particularly with many of the new donors who are coming online. And I think one of the great opportunities in Boston is for Barr to play a role with many others, including a great community foundation at the Boston Foundation, led ably by my colleague Paul Grogan, to work in partnership with the philanthropic community in Boston to think about the kind of philanthropic community that we want to be, what we aspire to, the ways that we can work together more effectively. And I've been very heartened by the level of collaboration and the willingness to find ways to partner together. Indeed, in reference earlier to the special initiative that I described, much of the work that we did in that initiative was in partnership with other local foundations in Boston, and quite frankly, following in the lead of those foundations who had done a lot of that work prior to our arrival on the scene.
Good insights. Let me ask you about your corporate culture at Barr, and I know that you give this a lot of thought and are very intentional around issues like this. As a matter of fact, you're one of the few leaders I know who thought less about what he was going to do when he came to an organization and more about how he was going to go about doing it. Describe the corporate culture and the things that you and your team have done to make it unique and distinctive and a special place to show up every morning.
Well, with regard to culture, I have to give credit where credit is due, and I give all credit for the culture at the Barr Foundation to our co-founders. Barbara and Amos Hostetter have created a culture at the Barr Foundation that is one deeply rooted in humility, that is around kindness and respect for the people that we work for, but all in the context of excellence and rigor and quality. And those happen to be values that I personally care deeply about. They happen to be values that I tried to advance in my work along with many others at the Irvine Foundation in California. So one of the principal reasons that I took this job at Barr was I felt such a deep alignment with the values of the founders of the Barr Foundation. And I arrived as a result to a culture that embodied all of that. And so now the opportunity to continue to foster that and to also think about ways that we continue to embed that culture into the deep DNA of our enterprise so that it's a culture that outlives all of us and that becomes part of the values of the way that institution functions decades from now.
And I know that's really what the co-founders care about more than anything else. How do you animate those values? You know, so often they're on a website or they're in a booklet you get when you show up. How do you make them live and breathe every day?
I think one of the ways is you make sure that you talk about them. We talk about our values a lot at the Barr Foundation. We recently had a staff retreat in August, and part of that retreat was focused on ways that we could be a constructive partner and ways that we live out those values in our day-to-day work. I think we aim to make them tangible. It's one thing, as you say, to say, well, we aim to be curious, we embrace risk, we're about excellence, we're about humility, but we think a lot about ways that we demonstrate that. So, for example, we think about how do we balance that tension between humility, which is a deeply held value, but also a commitment to leadership. And leadership not just in the sense of investing in leaders, but leadership in the sense of understanding what our role as a leadership institution is. And so we explicitly discuss those issues as a staff and learn from one another and engage with each other. And I think that contributes to making it clear that those values are animated on a daily basis.
Let me close with this, Jim. We are in some extraordinary times. And during these extraordinary times, you believe, as you mentioned before, philanthropy has to adapt. You also are a champion of foundations losing some of their reticence, finding their voice, and really stepping forward and speaking out on issues of importance. What has the Barr Foundation done in this regard, and what are your hopes for the sector at large in how they respond to the current challenges we all face?
I think when we think about foundations, we immediately think about the financial resources that foundations have. We are grant-making institutions, after all, and one of our purposes is to award those grants to institutions doing work aligned with our priorities. But I also think that we have an obligation to think about the other kinds of resources that we can bring to the table that advance the issues that we care deeply about. And I've long believed that foundations should think about when the strategic and thoughtful use of their voice, of their platform, ideally of the reputation that they hold, is wise to employ to advance the issues that we care deeply about. So I've thought about this quite a bit. We have a real commitment to transparency at the Barr Foundation. I blog a great deal. I'm active on Twitter, which incidentally I found a really valuable way to engage directly with people and get direct real-time feedback.
Well, somebody else has too.
From people. It's just the reality, which I love. But I do think that the idea of foundations using their voice is one that we all need to be thinking about when we're in philanthropic roles. I don't think it's a resource that we should be leaving on the table. And I think often in philanthropy we do. Mm-hmm. And I think we often do it at our peril as it relates to advancing our objectives.
Well, Jim Canales, the president and CEO of the Barr Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening and for a really interesting conversation. Tell us about your website and anything there that you think people might find of particular interest.
Terrific. So our website is at Barr Foundation, BARRFoundation.org. And hopefully you will find it a very vibrant, transparent, and also engaging website. I think I would particularly point you to our blog, where we are blogging all of the time about issues that we're engaging with. We invite some of our partners to guest blog as well. And also a number of us are active on social media. So we would urge you to follow us on Twitter.
I read your blog all the time, and it's a great investment in time. Thanks so much, Jim. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Denver, thanks for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/business of giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
with in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.